Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Non-compete agreements, that is, those binding contracts between an employer and an employee that bans the employee from working for a competitor, they're popular in Ohio and across the country, but are they fair? The Federal Trade Commission in early January proposed a new rule to ban the use of non-compete clauses, which currently affect employment for some 30 million Americans. Wall Street Journal reporter Lauren Weber writes about workplace issues and employment and has been covering the proposed changes and what they mean for workers and the economy. Lauren, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
I mentioned that 30 million Americans are bound by these non-compete clauses. Can you give us a thumbnail of which industries use them the most, or is there any pattern here?
Sure. Well, when non-competes first started being used, and that was probably a few decades ago, they mostly applied to people who really had access to sensitive information, trade secrets, secret formulas. So it probably would have been top executives, top salespeople, and scientists. Over the last couple of decades, they have applied to a much wider swath of workers. So, you now see them being applied in employment contracts for baristas, for social workers, for people at all levels of the corporate environment.
And what's driving that expansion to so many different sectors?
It's not entirely clear, but a lot of people that I've spoken to have speculated that it's partly because of the internet. It has made it very easy for any business, any employment lawyer to find a template for an agreement like this, drop it into an employment contract. And then, the way it works is most people start a job on the day one, you're sitting at a conference room table signing a bunch of paperwork, and there's a clause in there you never were able to negotiate, and you're suddenly under a lot of pressure to sign it. So a lot of people have ended up signing these, often feeling like they have no choice.
How are they currently used in employment contracts? It sounds like you're saying it's just sort of boilerplate at this point, being used across the board.
There is a lot of boilerplate, in some cases, there might be changes. For example, some non-compete agreements will say, will restrict somebody's ability to take a different job for a certain period of time, 6 months, a year, 2 years. Sometimes it's a geographic area, so you can't take a job doing something similar in a radius of 25 miles or something like that. So there are distinctions, it just has become so easy to include them in a contract. And what's kind of interesting is often you find them in contracts where they're not even enforceable based on the states where the person is working.
So some states ban them already.
Yeah. So this has been regulated at the state level, basically. The idea is up until perhaps the FTC passes its rule. Some states like California, North Dakota, Oklahoma ban virtually all non-competes. Other states might, and in the last few years, states have gotten a little bit more proactive about this. So some states have restrictions like you can't apply them to workers earning less than, say, $100,000 a year or in certain industries. And some states have very, very open interpretation. So you can have any kind of a non-compete. And then if it ends up getting challenged, it will go to a court.
You told me about a couple states that ban them, and it spans the spectrum from North Dakota to California. So this isn't necessarily a red or a blue thing.
No, and that's really interesting. This kind of cuts across traditional political lines. And I think part of that is because competition and the concept of a free market, whether that's for, finding customers or finding employees, finding talent, the idea that businesses should be able to compete unfettered, that is a concept that appeals to people across the political spectrum. So it's interesting to find, this is not an issue that tacks easily along partisan lines.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about non-compete clauses in employee contracts. They ban or limit the extent to which an employee can seek employment outside of that job with competition and competitive firms. My guest is Lauren Weber. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She's been covering the issue. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'd love to hear from people who are engaged in a non-compete clause right now or have been in the past and can tell us what their experience has been. 614-292-8513. You know, when you talk about businesses, the idea that business should be able to compete unfettered, but it sort of cuts both ways, doesn't it? Because when you ban one person from going somewhere else to work, you're fettering the other place that might want to hire them, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, that's why the argument is that these get in the way of free competition. And that's why the FTC sees it within its own purview, because it regulates competition. But there are a lot of businesses that are very anxious about the idea of a ban, because a lot of them really do rely on non-compete agreements. Partly it is to protect, often it's the customer list. They don't want somebody to leave their business and take customers with them or start soliciting their customers. But it is also, especially at a time when companies are really worried about retaining workers, and we've had a lot of people quitting jobs in the last few years, this ends up being a retention tool for workers. It was not meant to be that. But it ends up serving that capacity. So companies are nervous about, many companies that I've spoken to are nervous about not having this tool available to them. However, if their competitors are also using non-competes, that restricts their ability to recruit from other companies or recruit the expertise that they need. So it is a double-edged sword, and hopefully there is some benefit even for companies that would like to have access to non-competes. They will be able to hopefully recruit more freely.
You know, I get the customer list thing, but a customer list, you can stop somebody from taking customer lists without doing a non-compete, right?
That is true. There are a lot of other tools in, the legal tool belt for that. You can include a non-solicitation clause in an employment contract, which means somebody who leaves your business, an employee who leaves can't solicit your customers or can't solicit your employees and poach your employees. You can have a non-disclosure clause. There's trade secret laws that protect actual trade secrets. When I've spoken to employment lawyers about these, especially those that represent companies and employers, they say, yes, those are all important tools, but they only apply after the fact. So you can only apply them when you have some evidence that someone has violated them. The reason they like non-competes is that it just prohibits a person from taking a job in the first place. So you don't have to worry about what they're doing once they leave.
And the issue of the length of time of the non-compete varies in the between industries, right?
Right. Well, it's not really between industries. You can have companies in the same industry using 6-month non-competes, okay, and others using 2-year non-competes.
The fast food sub maker, what was it? Jimmy John's mm-hmm. was famously had a non-compete clause, and it sort of made people sit up and smell the roast turkey sandwich, I guess. People thought it sounded ridiculous.
Well, I really can't understand the justification for saying there are trade secrets involved in how you make a sandwich. And it's not just sandwich makers, it's security guards, it's all kinds of people who you would really have to wonder, what is the trade secret you're protecting? It can't be how to make a latte. I'm sorry, but all kinds of people can learn how to make a latte. A lot of times employers are counting on the fact that their employees will not challenge, because most people cannot afford to call a lawyer. Most people don't even know their rights. Many people don't even know they've signed something like this. And even if they have, they don't know that it might be unenforceable, and they don't have the resources to find an employment lawyer who would potentially take on a case like this for a single individual, often against a deep-pocketed company. That's one reason why companies have been able to get away for so long with what are clearly unenforceable non-compete clauses.
We have lemon laws out there for buying a bad car or whatever, a bad appliance, you can get your money back sort of a thing. Do any of the states employ that kind of a thing where you can do a take back? After
no,
signing that kind of contract, I should say.
Right. I mean, your only choice really is to, you know, if your employer tries to enforce this by sending you a cease and desist letter or trying to get an injunction against you taking another job, you know, your option basically is to try to find a lawyer who will fight that for you and bring it to court. And you don't know how courts are going to rule.
What's the timing of this for the FTC? Why now?
Well, Joe Biden, soon after he became president, he signed an executive order basically directing the FTC to take a close look at non-competes. This was an issue he was really interested in from the beginning. So we've known for about a year and a half that this was coming, that the FTC was looking into it. Now, at this point, the agency has a 60-day comment period. Anybody can go onto the website and put in a comment, submit a comment, and then the agency, after considering those, will come out with its final rule sometime after that.
Is the push to ban non-compete clauses coming from labor? Where's it coming from?
Well, you know, Biden has presented himself and tried to pass a lot of legislation as being, you know, somebody who's a supporter of workers and workers' rights. And this is a big issue for many, many workers. And, you know, when the FTC announced its proposed rule, they said that non-competes deprive workers of about $300 billion a year in lost income. That's a huge number, and I'm not exactly sure what their math is. But by restricting competition, you're also restricting people from being able to leave one job for a better wage somewhere else. When someone can leave for a better wage somewhere else, it not only lifts their own wages, but it can lift others' wages because that employer that's paying them more maybe is, you know, now has to raise pay for the people who are currently working there, or, you know, it raises pay for that role or that occupation because of just sort of how information passes through the marketplace. So that's the idea. It's not just hurting the wages of people subject to non-compete clauses, but others as well. So the idea is that by suppressing competition, you're also suppressing the wages. And Biden has a very clear interest in taking that, you know, barrier away. Now, I will say another part of it is that there's a real argument to be made that non-competes also suppress innovation and entrepreneurship, because in many non-compete clauses, it says not only can you not take a job with a competitor, you also can't start your own business. There's a lot of people who say that Silicon Valley developed where it is and the way it is, partly because California does not allow non-competes. So anybody with a great idea working for a company of any kind, let's say a tech company, could leave and start their own business. And so you had this incredible ecosystem of innovation there. And, you know, arguably non-competes have some role to play in that. The lack of non-competes has a role to play in that.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is challenging this, but it's not necessarily on the principles. It's more they're saying that the FTC is overreaching here. It isn't authorized to do this kind of thing.
Right. I mean, this is a business regulation, and the Chamber of Commerce, you know, they oppose most forms of business regulation, you know, and I think they said in their statement that non-competes can be reasonable, can be applied reasonably. But yeah, they're saying basically that the FTC is overreaching and doesn't have the authority to make a rule like this and that it should be left to states and to courts.
So you mentioned some of the states. Is it pretty split down the middle? I know Ohio allows non-compete clauses. Is it more common to allow them than not?
There has been a lot of activity at the state level in the last few years as some of the most egregious examples of non-compete clauses have come out much more in the public. So there's been a lot of activity, you know, just in the last 5 years or so. So it's hard to say, you know, I think if things had continued even without the FTC's intervention, I think we would have seen more and more states pass restrictions.
Do you see them finding some kind of middle ground on this, like not an out, you know, negotiating something in the final analysis, not an outright ban, but maybe something in between?
That is the big open question. I mean, right now what they've proposed is a pretty broad ban, like just about any kind of non-compete would be banned. Some observers are expecting them to narrow that a little bit by, you know, restricting it to people earning above a certain threshold, or maybe the time that a non-compete can apply, or something like that. But I don't know. I mean, I really do feel we could see it go anyway.
Lauren Weber, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Lauren Weber is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She has been writing about non-compete clauses and the FTC's plan to ban the use of non-compete clauses across the country. Currently, non-compete clauses affect the employment of some 30 million Americans. We have more to come on this topic, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. About 1 in 5 workers in the U.S. are bound by non-compete clauses in their contracts. A non-compete is a binding contract between an employer and an employee that bans the employee from working for a competitor. Studies show that such clauses can adversely affect hiring, competitiveness, and wages. We're looking at a recent FTC proposal to ban the use of non-compete clauses across the country. Ryan Nunn is an Assistant Vice President of Community Development and Engagement at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. In 2020, he testified to the FTC about his research on non-compete clauses and their impacts. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Rachel Arnau Richman is the Gerald A. Rosenthal Chair in Labor and Employment Law at the University of Florida. She recently co-authored an article for The Hill that explains why a nationwide ban on non-compete clauses would be good for business. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You write that the ban would be good for business, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce apparently begs to differ. I guess they're opposing it. It argues that the FTC is overstepping its bounds. Why would the ban be good for business, Rachel Arnau Richman?
Well, there are a number of different indicators of growth, firm development, increased wages, and other indicators of economic value that come with greater mobility and greater competitiveness. I think it's important to understand, and I will defer to Ryan on some of the details of the economic studies, but I think it's important to sort of set the baseline and appreciate that what these agreements do is they prevent competition. And competition is a critical value. It is a foundational aspect of our economy. And anti-competitive practices are barred by any number of laws, our antitrust laws being a prime example. So we sort of already know and understand as a general principle that competition is healthy for the economy. And so in thinking about, any change in policy, it's important, notwithstanding sort of the business presentation of their particular interests, to sort of realize what the public policy is here. The FTC and the FTC Act, you mentioned the agency that is issuing this, this rule proposing to ban non-competes. That agency was found as part of the trust-busting progressive era in our country. Businesses did not want to be regulated. The robber barons of the industrial era wanted to decrease competition and be monopolies. And so as a public policy, we value competition more than those particular interests that are asserted by individual businesses.
And Ryan Nunn, the research you've done underscores what happens, and how non-competes affect the flow of ideas and wages, right?
Yeah, so something I've been thinking and writing about for a while now is the lack of labor market and business dynamism in the United States that's really become a concern, where we don't see workers switching jobs, switching location as frequently as we'd like. We see fewer startups, and non-competes are bound up in this story. So, you know, as Rachel alluded to, we have some really exciting evidence from just the last few years on non-competes and what kind of effects they've had on things like the dissemination of new scientific findings. That is reduced by strictly enforced non-competes, because to the extent that workers can't move easily across firms, you see less dissemination of those findings. You also see startups that have more trouble scaling up, more trouble surviving when they can't hire, because non-competes are common in their industry. So we are getting a lot of really interesting evidence that's helping to illuminate some of these costs for the overall economy.
And the, I guess, countervailing evidence isn't necessarily there. When I was talking with Lauren Weber of the Wall Street Journal, she said the growth of non-competes perhaps is a big function of just the internet age and just boilerplate language being thrown into contracts. Do you, Ryan Nunn, have any insights into how it came to this, that 30 million Americans are bound by these things?
I think that's a great question. Unfortunately, our data are pretty limited in this space. So we really only started to learn about how ubiquitous non-competes were just a few years ago, a little less than 10 years ago. So we don't have the data that would allow us to closely track the evolution of non-competes over time. It is widely believed that that non-competes have become increasingly used for lower wage workers in particular, but it is something where, you know, we're now getting great data. It's helping us to understand what's going on, but it's a little hard to speak to the evolution of it.
Rachel Arno Richmond, any insights on your side?
Well, so I agree with Ryan about the state of the data. We are limited in that regard, but I think, Anne, your instinct is a good one. What we have is a world where corporate HR departments are very capable, you know, advised by counsel, of, you know, introducing standard form agreements and simply require them of all their workers. And I think it's important here to distinguish between sort of the hypothetical model of how non-competes are executed and the reality. You know, the justifications for non-competes, and I'm sure Ryan will speak more to this, you know, involve a sort of a knowing trade-off between a business and a sophisticated worker, where the business is entrusting valuable information, relationships, customer goodwill, and investing in that worker. And supposedly, according to these accounts, the worker receives a wage premium for signing the non-compete. And it's probably the case that in some limited number of situations, and to think about high-level executives who have comprehensive written agreements, that very well may be happening, or at least the parties may be intending that type of an arrangement. But that's just not the reality. We know that only about 10% of employees actually bargain and, you know, discuss or negotiate the non-compete. We know that about 30 to 40% of them don't even receive the non-compete until they start working. And so what that suggests is that employees are accepting a job, you know, based on terms that are put forth that are what we would describe as salient to workers, like their pay and their title. And then in the process of onboarding, they're given a number of forms and simply asked to sign. You know, in that environment, workers are not making a knowing choice. They may not even notice the non-compete. And certainly, and I think this is important, even if they do, they're no longer in a position to refuse to sign. The other sort of important background detail here is that workers in this country are employed at will. That means that the company can insist on terms of employment like a non-compete on threat of termination.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about non-compete clauses. The Federal Trade Commission is looking to ban them nationwide. There's a six-month process ahead, a 60-day, I apologize, a 60-day public information period before they take action on this. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests, you just heard Rachel Arno-Richmond. She's a professor of law and the inaugural Gerald A. Rosenthal Chair in Labor and Employment Law at the University of Florida. Also with us, Ryan Nunn, Assistant Vice President of Community Development and Engagement at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Again, the number is 614-292-8513. And Laura in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I needed to comment on this because I worked for... On a personal level, I worked for a company with a non-compete for many years.
Uh-huh.
And it was used as a furtherance of the two economies in the United States, the ones for the, at the very top and the people on the bottom that are not thriving. It was used as a kind of tyranny. And we were told if there was ever a comment, a complaint, a suggestion, if you don't like it, just leave. Well, that made it awful difficult, and it made it awfully unpleasant, and it kept the workers in a powerless position.
I see. They used the non-compete as a threat. They knew you couldn't find another job.
Absolutely.
Okay. Laura, could you tell me what the business was by any chance? Can you?
The only reason why I don't want to tell is it would make it really obvious it's a very unique business.
Okay.
And it's a big business in Columbus. I mean, it's very successful business in Columbus.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your insights. Thanks, Laura. I kind of get now better from listening to Laura about how it holds people back. It's not just that you can't go out and get another job in the same business. It's used as a threat knowingly. That's kind of a little even creepier, Rachel Arno-Richmond.
First of all, I really feel for you, Linda. I think that's an impossible situation and a really unfair one. I'm sort of curious if you're still in that job. But let me just say that, that's exactly the dimension of the problem that I think doesn't get appreciated, which is that, you know, on the one hand, these agreements prevent you from going to another employer if you're unhappy in your job, but they also prevent you from effectively negotiating to improve your conditions of employment in the job you're in. And there's an old saying, right? The only way up is out. Some of us have heard that in terms of improving along a promotion ladder or increasing your wages in a company, the threat of departure is really the worker's only real leverage. And so that is taken away from workers. And again, the irony here is that employers are free to terminate workers at any time. And that is an important value that we have in terms of giving employers discretion. In theory, employees should have the same discretion. And this type of instrument, this type of contract, lets employers, sort of have their cake and eat it too.
Ryan Nunn, can you give us a little bit of a breakdown about, you know, where the states are on this and where Ohio stands on it?
The states do vary quite widely. So there are three states that simply don't enforce non-competes. Ohio is on the stricter side of enforcement. So, you know, some notable aspects of how Ohio treats this. You can be laid off without cause, and a non-compete can still be enforced against you in Ohio. I find that rather striking. It's also the case that courts, if they encounter a contract in Ohio that is unenforceably broad, so it's written in a way that is too strict, the courts can simply rewrite that contract and then enforce it. And that's seen as an arrangement that is pretty employer-friendly. So, you know, I think that it's important to think about how these kinds of enforcement regimes differ across states and to recognize when there's a state that's, you know, that is quite strict in its enforcement.
I'm not sure I understand the role of courts in this in Ohio. You said that they can find for a plaintiff, but then just rewrite the contract, and you're saying it can be beneficial to employers?
Yeah. So in many states, what will happen with a non-compete that's found to be unenforceably broad is that clause can just simply be thrown out, and then it won't be enforced against the worker. a different way of treating this, as is the case in Ohio, is that the courts can, you know, find that that non-compete was too broad, but then they can just limit the parts of the clause that are too broad and then enforce what remains. And that allows, that gives employers a little more freedom to be quite aggressive in how they write the contract. And because so few of non-competes actually go into litigation, it really matters what's on the page, what the employer can say to the worker could be enforced against them when it comes to worker behavior.
What would the FTC proposed rule change do from a legal standpoint? So just a ban, they would just go away, Rachel Arno Richmond?
So essentially, that is what this version of the rule seeks to do. It would effectively prevent non-competes in the employment context. There are business uses of non-competes that are not affected by this rule. And in addition to preventing the use of non-competes, it would prevent the type of threatening behavior that the caller spoke about, efforts to enforce non-competes. And very importantly, it would also require employers to rescind past non-competes. In other words, they would have to inform their workers who had previously signed non-competes that they would no longer be bound by them. And I guess I'll just add on that note why I think that particular piece is so important. You know, and in echoing what Ryan said about what is on the page, even an employer that is relatively hands-off and doesn't threaten to use a non-compete, even in that situation, the employee is still, you know, is risk averse. And if the employee knows that he or she has signed a non-compete, even if the employer isn't threatening to use it, that creates a real risk that, you know, most workers are not sort of able or willing to tolerate in terms of leaving a job and potentially getting sued. And even employers tend to be risk averse in hiring workers that have signed non-competes. And this goes to your question about the role of the court and the problem here. The problem with the modification or reformation process that Ryan described is that it gives employers every incentive to overreach in drafting the contract. There are no penalties, and this is an important point, there are no penalties on an employer right now in most jurisdictions for requesting a non-compete that is too broad. And so if the non-compete is brought to court and the court concludes that it is an overreach, in most jurisdictions, the courts will simply modify it. And so the employee is in a real state of uncertainty in general. And when you add to that the variations in different state laws, questions about which state law applies, it's a situation that's fraught with risk.
When they do this reformation at the court level, and Ryan, chime in if you have some insights on this, when they, you know, modify a non-compete, is it just for that employee who has brought it to court, or is it writ large across the company for all employees in that rank or that kind of a thing? Ryan Nunn, do you have, or
it's at the individual level, so okay. It will apply to that
so
person,
it's been found overly broad for one person, but they're only going to apply the amendments to that one person.
That's correct.
Right. And that, you know, as you, I'll just chime in here. And so the implication, of course, is that there may be many, many other workers at that company who have signed the same non-compete. And it's not simply a question of getting the information out to the workers. You know, under the current regime that we have in the states, the court's decision could vary applying the same exact non-compete to different workers. And it's probably, you know, it makes sense to sort of back up here a minute and just sort of explain what the state law is. You know, Ryan said there are three states, and most notably California, where they're not enforced. I'm overgeneralizing greatly here, but the remainder of the jurisdictions generally permit quote unquote reasonable non-competes, reasonable in their scope and in connection to what is often described as a legitimate or proprietary interest of the employer. So that's an incredibly vague standard. And when it comes to the employer's interests and what would be deemed reasonable, everything depends on the situation that the parties are in at the time that non-compete enforcement is sought. The court is making an individualized assessment of what information the worker has access to, what type of competition they plan to engage in, as well as what the employer's underlying concerns are. And so that is necessarily a fact-specific and case-by-case analysis.
We have to take a quick break here, but I'm wondering real quickly if anyone's ever tried a class action, like many employees from the same firm working together against a non-compete provision. Nothing? No?
Well, there have been a few.
Okay.
There have been a few, I wouldn't describe them as class actions, but collective efforts to sort of address this problem. Oftentimes, what we've seen in recent years is efforts on the part of individual state attorney general's offices to sort of investigate the use and try to prosecute the use of these agreements. That's been somewhat successful in Washington state, where there have been a few settlements reached. That is, certainly one method of approaching this. It does require resources and commitment of a particular state agency.
We're going to take a quick break. That is Rachel Arno Richmond. She's a professor of law and the inaugural Gerald A. Rosenthal Chair in Labor and Employment Law at the University of Florida. Also with us, Ryan Nunn. He's Assistant Vice President of Community Development and Engagement for the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. We're talking about non-compete clauses. The Federal Trade Commission is proposing a nationwide ban and rescinding all non-compete clauses in the United States. If you have worked under a non-compete clause, give us a call. Tell us what your story is. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Federal Trade Commission proposal to ban and rescind all non-compete clauses in the U.S. Still with us, Rachel Arno Richmond. She's the Gerald A. Rosenthal Chair in Labor and Employment Law at the University of Florida. And Ryan Nunn, Assistant Vice President of Community Development and Engagement at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Ryan, let's talk pros and cons of non-compete, what it costs us and what it brings to the table. It started out maybe as a noble gesture at some point.
Absolutely. So, and I should preface this by just saying that this is my assessment of the evidence and not that of anyone else in the Federal Reserve System. But, I see the original justification for non-competes as being primarily about trade secrets. So the idea is that with a non-compete, you can make it so that an employer can securely share trade secrets with their worker, knowing that they will not be able to take those trade secrets to some other firm. So that's kind of the core of the traditional justification. I think there are also benefits to firms that insist on the non-competes just because they can reduce turnover in a way that's really cheap for them, and they can improve their bargaining power with respect to the worker. I mean, I'm actually trying to hire someone in my group right now, and it's a real pain to replace staff who've left. It's disruptive to the work that I do and everyone else does. So those are sort of the benefits. But on the cost side, I think we've already talked about a few of them, but there's quite a bit. The workers themselves, even those who haven't signed non-competes, tend to be worse off because there are fewer firms out there looking to hire them. So their bargaining power can be impaired by these non-competes. Importantly, other firms, including startups that are trying to hire a lot of folks, trying to scale up, they do worse. And we have some great evidence on their outcomes. And then what all this means, I think, for the overall economy is that you end up with worse matches between workers and firms. And I think this is really important because if we want to have robust productivity growth and a robust economy, we need workers to be matched with the jobs where they are best suited to apply their talents.
And, you know, Rachel, you talked earlier about business uses of non-compete are not addressed in this ban. So is that part of this rulemaking process? They'll be sussing, okay, how does that work?
No. So there are non-competes that are used business to business when assets are sold, and that is not affected by this proposed rule. I think Ryan sort of laid out the typical justification rather well, and also raised sort of a concerning point, which is correct that for companies it's easy to use these to reduce turnover, and one thing that is clear in the existing law that we have is that is not a justification for using a non-compete. Sort of that goes to the heart of the free contract system that we have and the employment at will system that we have, that workers are free to leave. And it also, I think, highlights sort of some of the possible alternatives here. There are lots of ways for companies to lawfully reduce turnover, starting with valuing their employees and giving them better terms of employment. There's also the possibility of giving and securing a commitment for a period of years, but employers don't want to be bound to keeping their workers. They only want to bind their workers to staying with them. So, you know, this is, I think, sort of another illustration of the problematic uses of non-competes that sort of fly under the radar because of the sort of patchwork and fact-specific system of enforcement. And it bears adding that, you know, while, you know, Ryan sort of illustrated really the contemporary justification in terms of trade secrets, the historical use of these agreements goes back hundreds of years to the guild system. And that was a system of indenturing trainees, is what we would call them, you know, today, but apprenticeships, to a particular master or craftsman, and keeping them in the fold to prevent those workers from being able to go out and start on their own. So they're really problematic historical uses of these agreements that defy the trade secret analysis. And I think in Ryan's description and what we're starting to see in terms of the proliferation, if you will, or at least the prominence of these agreements, is that there's a lot of that probably still going on.
Let's see. John in Lima, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
You know, the first thing that flew through my mind when I heard about the non-compete is that this sounds like something the mafia would come up with. You know, don't go join the family across town or we'll come shoot you up.
Huh. Interesting. I mean, it is a control. I mean, obviously, a huge control mechanism. It's thank you, John, for that call. How would this rule change affect how people search for jobs? And what I mean, I suppose part of this, regardless of what happens at the FTC level and until they change it and put the ban in place, people need to be asking about this, right, Rachel? I mean, this is something people should be asking about in advance when they're signing all those papers during the onboarding process or before the onboarding process, maybe.
Ideally before, and you know, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, there's been a lot of reform at the state level in the last 10 or so years, and a few states have enacted notice requirements that sort of go to this point of trying to give workers more awareness about the non-competes that they're signing, more opportunity to look at them and to understand them. But, you know, we have to sort of recognize the limits of that change. It still doesn't give the worker sort of the power to turn down the job. And we have to remember that, you know, workers sort of, you know, anyone's ability to or willingness to bargain over, you know, a term of employment that, you know, may or may not actually come into play is relatively limited. You know, and this is where behavioral economics tells us about, you know, sort of our own biases and what we prioritize in the negotiation. And even if, you know, one thinks that's all well and good and that, you know, workers should be responsible for their decisions in that situation, it doesn't address sort of the problematic externalities, the public consequences that Ryan described. You know, on a happy note, what I will say is that I think that this proposed ban on whether or not it actually goes into effect, I do hope that it does. It certainly will raise some awareness amongst workers about the use of these agreements. So perhaps that might be a positive.
I'm wondering to the extent to which non-compete clauses hampered the economy and the labor market during the pandemic when so many people were at first laid off, you know, fired because of the pandemic, but then they were still covered by the non-compete clause, Ryan Nunn, right? I mean, I'm kind of thinking banning non-compete clauses might enable the labor market to respond more nimbly during these kinds of disruptions.
That's absolutely the hope, that that by reforming how we use non-competes, banning them, that we make for a more flexible labor market, more dynamism in the economy. The evidence we have, some of the best evidence we have on effects on workers' wages comes from well before the pandemic. Looking at Oregon and Hawaii, when they implemented two different reforms that respectively banned non-competes for workers earning below a wage threshold, and then also for tech workers in Hawaii. And what they found was that wages rose after those reforms were implemented. They also found that worker mobility increased. So that would be consistent with that hypothesis that non-competes would help there.
If they're controlled by the states at this point, could I be beholden to a non-compete clause in Ohio if I moved to Oregon?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Again, state law varies. And one of the sort of touch points for the recent reform efforts at different states was to try to rein in that problem. But again, it's an area that's fraught with uncertainty. And I just reviewed a non-compete last week and for a worker in Florida, where I teach, and it stipulated the law of New Jersey would apply. And that's because companies, particularly companies operating in multiple jurisdictions, are going to specify the law and the courts of their own jurisdiction as the sort of enforcing location and the body of applicable rules. And what we've seen in some high profile cases, and this is incredibly costly, is parallel litigation in which an employer tries to, you know, sue a worker in the state where it's located. The worker may try to sue to stop the non-compete in the location that they are in. And courts take different views, absent any legislation to guide them, about whether they will respect what we call a choice of law clause in the non-compete. That is, whether they will insist on applying their own state law, usually where the worker is, or applying the law that the company has sought to impose.
Yeah, Ryan Nunn?
Just a quick thing to add to that is that we have some evidence that when workers are bound by non-competes, that they tend to take career detours. They tend to leave the field that they've been working in order to escape the bounds of the non-compete, and that can have costs for the economy and for the worker.
Where do things, I mean, so we've got a 60-day waiting period here for these rules. I'm going to ask both of you, we are running out of, we have like a minute left, but I'm curious if you think it's going to be a flat-out ban across the board, or do you think they're going to negotiate something more toward the middle? Ryan Nunn?
So I'm just an economist. I wouldn't want to speak to the outcome of this, either
okay.
In terms of rulemaking or law.
Okay. And then Rachel?
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question. You know, there's been a lot of noise about whether the FTC has the authority to introduce a rule like this. And, you know, on the face of the Federal Trade Act, it's, you know, very explicit that the FTC has broad authority. The law says that they're empowered and directed to prevent companies from using unfair methods of competition. And they very clearly and explicitly have rulemaking authority. You know, a lot depends on the political climate. I think, Amit, you said that that's one possibility, is that, you know, the FTC will take comments and maybe issue a more dialed back version of this. It's also possible that they go forward and there are legal challenges. But for now, we just have to wait.
Rachel Arno-Richmond, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it. Rachel Arno-Richmond is professor of law at the University of Florida. Also, Ryan Nunn, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ryan Nunn is Assistant Vice President of Community Development and Engagement at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. That's it for now. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.